His mouth was opening and closing like a fish, but he wasn't talking. So I told him we knew about the cops getting beaten up. I asked him who else was involved. I told him we knew about hiding the body under the cardboard. He wouldn't say a damn word. He just kept looking around. After a while, I realized he was thinking like crazy, trying to decide what to tell me. He just kept silent, thinking like mad. Must have been 40 minutes. The tape was running the whole time, recorded 40 minutes of silence. Finley stopped again, this time for effect. He looked at me. "Then he confessed," he said. "I did it," he said. "I shot him," he said. "The guy is confessing, right? On the tape." "Go on," I said. I asked him, "Do you want a lawyer?" he said. He says no, keeps repeating he killed the guy. So I Mirandize him, loud and clear, on the tape. Then I think to myself, maybe he's crazy or something, you know? So I ask him, "Who did you kill?" He says, "The tall guy with the shaved head." I ask him, "How?" He says, "Shot him in the head." I ask him, "When?" He says, "Last night, about midnight." I ask him, "Who kicked the body around? Who was the guy? What does pluribus mean?" He doesn't answer. Goes rigid with fright all over again, refuses to say a damn word. I say to him, "I'm not sure you did anything at all." He jumps up and grabs me. He's screaming, "I confess, I confess, I shot him, I shot him." I shove him back. He goes quiet. Finley sat back, folded his hands behind his head, looked a question at me. "Hubble as the shooter?" I didn't believe it, because of his agitation. Guys who shoot somebody with an old pistol, in a fight or in a temper, a messy shot to the chest, they get agitated afterward. Guys who put two bullets in the head with a silencer, then collect up the shell cases, they're a different class of person. They don't get agitated afterward. They just walk away and forget about it. Hubble was not the shooter. The way he had been dancing around in front of the reception counter proved it. But I just shrugged and smiled. "Okay," I said. "You can let me go now, right?" Finley looked at me and shook his head. "Wrong," he said. "I don't believe him. There were three guys involved here. You persuaded me of that yourself. So which one is Hubble claiming to be? I don't think he's the maniac. I can't see enough strength in him for that. I don't see him as the gopher. And he's definitely not the shooter, for God's sake. Guy like that couldn't shoot pool." I nodded, like Finley's partner, worrying away at a problem. "Got to throw his ass in the can, for now," he said. "No option. He's confessed. Couple of plausible details. But it definitely won't hold up." I nodded again, sensed there was something more to come. "Go on," I said, with resignation. Finley looked at me, a level gaze. "He wasn't even there at midnight," he said. "He was at some old couple's anniversary party. A family thing, not far from where he lives. Got there around 8 last night. He had walked down with his wife. Didn't leave until after 2 o'clock in the morning. 2 dozen people saw him arrive, 2 dozen people saw him leave. He got a ride home from his sister-in-law's brother-in-law. He got a ride because it was already pouring rain by then." "Go on, Finley," I said. "Tell me." "His sister-in-law's brother-in-law," he said, drove him home in the rain, 2 o'clock in the morning? Officer Stevenson. 5. Finley leaned right back in his chair. His long arms were folded behind his head. He was a tall, elegant man, educated in Boston, civilized, experienced. And he was sending me to jail for something I hadn't done. He levered himself upright, spread his hands on the desk, palms up. "I'm sorry, Reacher," he said to me.
"You're sorry," I said.
"You're sending two guys who couldn't have done it to jail, and you're sorry." He shrugged, looked unhappy about it.
"This is the way Chief Morrison wants it," he said. "He's calling it a done deal, closing us down for the weekend. And he's the boss man, right?"
"You gotta be joking," I said. "He's an asshole. He's calling Stevenson a liar, his own man."
"Not exactly," Finley shrugged. "He's saying it's maybe a conspiracy. You know, maybe Hubble wasn't literally there, but he recruited you to do it. A conspiracy, right? He reckons the confession is exaggerated because maybe Hubble's afraid of you and is scared to finger you right away. Morrison figures you were on your way down to Hubble's place to get paid when we hauled you in. He figures that's why you waited the 8 hours. Figures that's why Hubble was at home today. Didn't go to work because he was waiting around to pay you off."
I was silent. I was worried. Chief Morrison was dangerous. His theory was plausible. Until Finley did the checking, if Finley did the checking.
"So, Reacher, I'm sorry," he said. "You and Hubble stay in the bag until Monday. You'll get through it, over in Warburton. Bad place, but the holding pens are okay. Worse if you go there for a stretch. Much worse. Meantime, I'll work on it before Monday. I'll ask Officer Roscoe to come in Saturday and Sunday. She's the pretty one outside. She's good. The best we got. If what you say is right, you'll be free and clear on Monday. Okay?"
I stared at him. I was getting mad.
"No, Finley. Not okay," I said.
"You know I didn't do a damn thing. You know it wasn't me. You're just shit scared of that useless fat bastard Morrison. So I'm going to jail because you're just a spineless damn coward."
He took it pretty well. His dark face flushed darker. He sat quietly for a long time. I took a deep breath and glared at him. My glare subsided to a gaze as my temper cooled. Back under control. His turn to glare at me.
"Two things, Reacher," he said. Precise articulation.
"First, if necessary, I'll take care of Chief Morrison on Monday. Second, I am not a coward. You don't know me at all. Nothing about me."
I gazed back at him. 6 o'clock, bus time.
"I know more than you think," I said. "I know you're a Harvard postgrad, you're divorced, and you quit smoking in April."
Finley looked blank. Baker knocked and entered to say the prison bus had arrived. Finley got up and walked around the desk, told Baker he would bring me out himself. Baker went back to fetch Hubble.
"How do you know that stuff?" Finley asked me.
He was intrigued. He was losing the game.
"Easy," I said. "You're a smart guy, right? Educated in Boston, you told me. But when you were college age, Harvard wasn't taking too many black guys. You're smart, but you're no rocket scientist. So I figure Boston U for the first degree, right?"
"Right," he conceded. "And then Harvard for postgrad," I said.
"You did well at Boston U. Life moved on. You got into Harvard. You talk like a Harvard guy. I figured it straight away.
PhD in criminology?
Right, he said again. Criminology. And then you got this job in April, I said. You told me that. You've got a pension from Boston PD because you did your 20. So you've come down here with cash to spare. But you've come down here with no woman, because if you had, she'd have spent some of that spare cash on new clothes for you. She probably hated that wintry tweed thing you're wearing. She'd have junked it and put you in a sunbelt outfit to start your new life on the right foot. But you're still wearing that terrible old suit, so the woman is gone. She either died or divorced you, so it was a 50-50 guess. Looks like I guessed right. He nodded blankly. And the smoking thing is easy, I said. You were just stressed out, then you were padding your pockets, looking for cigarettes. That means you quit fairly recently. Easy guess is you quit in April. You know, new life, new job, no more cigarettes. You figured quit now and you might beat the cancer thing. Finley glared at me, a bit grudging. Very good, Reacher, he said. Elementary deduction, right? I shrugged, didn't say anything. So deduce who aced the guy up at the warehouse, he said. I don't care who aced any guy anywhere, I said. That's your problem, not mine. And it's the wrong question, Finley. First, you got to find out who the guy was, right? So you got any way to do that, smart guy? He asked me. No ID, no face left, nothing from the prints. Hubble won't say diddly. Run the prints again, I said. I'm serious, Finley. Get Roscoe to do it. Why? He said. Something wrong there, I said. What something? He asked me. Run them again, okay? I said. Would you do that? He just grunted, didn't say yes or no. I opened the office door and stepped out. Roscoe had gone. Nobody was there except Baker and Hubble over at the cells. I could see the desk sergeant outside through the front doors. He was writing on a clipboard held by the prison bus driver. As a backdrop, behind the two of them was the prison bus. It was stationary in the semicircular driveway. It filled the view through the big plate-glass entrance. It was a school bus painted light gray. On it was written, State of Georgia Department of Corrections. That inscription ran the full length of the bus, under the line of windows. Under the inscription was a crest. The windows had grills welded over them. Finley came out of the office behind me, touched my elbow, and walked me over to Baker. Baker was holding three sets of handcuffs hooked over his thumb. They were painted bright orange. The paint was chipped. Dull steel showed through. Baker snapped a pair of handcuffs onto each of my wrists, separately. He unlocked Hubble's cell and signaled a scared banker to come out. Hubble was blank and dazed, but he stepped out. Baker caught the dangling cuff on my left wrist and snapped it onto Hubble's right wrist. He put the third set of cuffs on Hubble's other wrist. Ready to go. Take his watch, Baker, I said. He'll lose it in jail. He nodded. He knew what I meant. Guy like Hubble could lose a lot in jail. Baker unlatched the heavy Rolex from Hubble's wrist. The bracelet wouldn't slide over the handcuff, so Baker had to fiddle and fuss with taking the handcuff off and putting it back on again. The prison driver cracked the door and glared in. A man with a timetable. Baker dropped Hubble's watch on the nearest desk, exactly where my friend Roscoe had put her coffee cup.
Okay, guys, let's hit the road, Baker said.
He walked us to the doors. We went out into a dazzling hot bar of sunshine, handcuffed together. Walking was awkward. Before crossing to the bus, Hubble stopped. He craned his neck and looked around carefully. He was being more vigilant than Baker or the prison driver, maybe scared of a neighbor seeing him. But there was nobody around. We were 300 yards north of the town. I could see the church steeple in the distance. We walked over to the bus through the evening warmth. My right cheek tingled in the low sun. The driver pushed the bus door inward. Hubble shuffled sideways onto the step. I followed him, made a clumsy turn into the aisle. The bus was empty. The driver directed Hubble into a seat. He slid over the vinyl to the window. I was pulled alongside. The driver knelt on the seat in front and clicked our outer wrists to the chromium hoop which ran across the top. He rattled each of our three cuffs in turn, wanted to know they were secure. I didn't blame him. I've done that job. Nothing worse than driving with prisoners loose behind you. The driver walked forward to his seat. He started the engine with a loud diesel clatter. The bus filled with vibration. The air was hot, stifling. There was no air conditioning. None of the windows opened. I could smell fuel fumes. The gears clashed and ground, and the bus moved off. I glanced out to my right. Nobody waving goodbye. We drove north out of the police lot, turning our backs on the town, heading up toward the highway. We passed Eno's diner after a half mile. His lot was empty. Nobody looking for an early dinner. We carried on north for a spell. Then we turned a tight left off the county road and struck out west, down a road between fields. The bus settled to a noisy cruise. Endless rows of bushes flicked past, endless drills of red earth between. Ahead of me, the sun was on the way down. It was a giant red ball heading for the fields. The driver had the large sun visor down. On it were printed manufacturer's instructions about how to operate the bus. Hubble rocked and bounced beside me. He said nothing. He had slumped down with his face parallel to the floor. His left arm was raised because it was handcuffed to the chrome bar in front of us. His right arm rested inert between us. He still had his expensive sweater draped across his shoulders. Where the Rolex had been was a band of pale skin. The life force had just about drained out of him. He was in the grip of a paralyzing fear. We rocked and bounced for the best part of another hour through the huge landscape. A small stand of trees flashed past on my right. Then, way in the far distance, I saw a structure. It sat alone in 1,000 acres of flat farmland. Against the low red sun, it looked like a protrusion from hell. Something forced up through the crust of the earth. It was a complex of buildings. Looked like a chemical factory or a nuclear place. Massive concrete bunkers and glittering metal walkways. Tubing running here and there with steam drifting. All surrounded with fencing, punctuated by towers. As we drew closer, I could see arc lights and razor wire. Searchlights and rifles in the towers. Layers of fences separated with plowed red earth. Hubble didn't look up. I didn't nudge him. It wasn't the magic kingdom up ahead. The bus slowed as we approached. The outermost fence was about 100 yards out, forming a giant perimeter. It was a substantial fence, possibly 15 feet tall, studded along its entire length with pairs of sodium floodlights. One of each pair was trained inward across the 100-yard breadth of plowed earth. One was trained out over the surrounding farmland. All the floodlights were lit. The whole complex blazed with yellow sodium light. Up close, it was very bright.
The yellow light turned the red earth to a ghastly tan. The bus rattled to a halt. The idling engine set up a vibration. What little ventilation there had been ceased. It was stifling. Hubble finally looked up. He peered out through his gold rims. He looked around him and out the window. He groaned. It was a groan of hopeless dejection. He dropped his head. The driver was waiting for a signal from the first gate guard. The guard was speaking into a radio. The driver blipped the engine and crunched into gear. The guard signaled to him, using his radio as a baton, waving us through. The bus ground forward into a cage. We passed a long, low sign at the curb. Warburton Correctional Facility. State of Georgia, Department of Corrections. Behind us, a gate swung closed. We were sealed in a wire cage. It was roofed with wire. At the far end, a gate swung open. The bus ground through. We drove the 100 yards to the next fence. There was another vehicle cage. The bus went in, waited, and drove on out. We drove right into the heart of the prison. We stopped opposite a concrete bunker, the reception area. The engine noise beat against the concrete surrounding us. Then it shut down, and the vibration and clatter died away to silence. The driver swung out of his seat and walked up the aisle, stooping, pulling himself like a climber on the seat backs. He pulled out his keys and unlocked the cuffs, fixing us to the seat in front.
"Okay, boys, let's go," he grinned. "Party time."
We hauled ourselves out of our seat and shuffled down the bus. My left arm was pulled back by Hubble. The driver stopped us at the front. He removed all 3 sets of handcuffs and dropped them in a bin next to his cab, hauled on a lever and sprang the door. We got out of the bus. A door opened opposite, and a guard stepped out, called us over. He was eating a donut and spoke with his mouth full. A sugar mustache frosted his lip. He was a pretty casual guy. We went through the door into a small concrete chamber. It was filthy. Deal chairs surrounded a painted table. Another guard sat on the table reading from a battered clipboard.
"Sit down, okay?" he said.
We sat. He stood up. His partner with the donut locked the outer door and joined him.
"Here's the deal," said the clipboard guy. "You guys are Reacher and Hubble in for Margrave. Not convicted of any crime. In custody pending investigation. No bail application for either of you. Hear what I say? Not convicted of any crime. That's the important thing. Excuses you from a lot of shit in here, okay? No uniform, no processing, no big deal. You understand? Nice accommodations on the top floor."
"Right," said the donut guy. "Thing is, if you were convicts, we'd be poking and prodding and hitting on you, and you'd get the uniform, and we'd shove you on the convict floors with the other animals, and we'd just sit back and watch the fun. Right?"
"Right," his partner said. "So what we're saying is this. We ain't here to give you a hard time, so don't you boys be giving us a hard time neither. You understand? This damn facility ain't got the manpower. Governor laid off about a half of the staff, okay? Got to meet the budget, right? Got to cut the deficit, right? So we ain't got the men to do the job the way it ought to be done. Trying to do our job with a half a crew on every shift, right? So what I'm saying is, we shove you in there, and we don't want to see you again until we pull you out on Monday. No hassle, right? We ain't got the manpower for hassle. We ain't got the manpower for hassle on the convict floors, let alone hassle on the hold'em floor, you understand?
Yo, Hubble, you understand?
Hubble looked up at him and nodded blankly, didn't speak.
Reacher,
the clipboard guy said.
You understand?
Sure, I said. I understood. This guy was understaffed, having problems because of a budget, while his friends collected unemployment. Tell me about it.
Good, he said. So the deal is this. The two of us are off duty at 7 o'clock, which is in about 1 minute's time. We ain't staying late for you boys. We don't want to, and the union wouldn't let us anyway. So you get a meal, then you're locked down in here until they got manpower to take you upstairs. No manpower until lights out. Maybe 10 o'clock, okay? But then, no guards will move prisoners around after lights out anyway, right? Union won't let them. So Spivey will come get you himself. Assistant warden. Top boy tonight. About 10 o'clock. Okay? You don't like it? You don't tell me. You tell the governor. Okay?
The donut eater went out into the corridor and came back a long moment later with a tray. On it were covered plates, paper cups, and a thermos. He put the tray on the table, and the two of them swung out through the corridor, locked the door from the outside. It went quiet as a tomb in there. We ate. Fish and rice. Friday food. Coffee in the thermos. Hubble didn't speak. He left most of the coffee for me. Score one for Hubble. I put the debris on the tray and the tray on the floor. Another 3 hours to waste. I tipped my chair back and put my feet up on the table. Not comfortable, but as good as I was going to get. A warm evening. September in Georgia. I looked over at Hubble without curiosity. He was still silent. I had never heard him speak except on Finley's speakerphone. He looked back at me. His face was full of dejection and fear. He looked at me like I was a creature from another world. He stared at me like I worried him. Then he looked away. Maybe I wouldn't head back to the Gulf, but it was too late in the year to head north. Too cold up there. Maybe skip right down to the islands. Jamaica, maybe. Good music there. A hut on the beach. Live out the winter in a hut on a Jamaica beach. Smoke a pound of grass a week. Do whatever Jamaica people do. Maybe 2 pounds of grass a week with someone to share the hut. Roscoe kept drifting into the picture. Her uniform shirt was fabulously crisp. A crisp, tight blue shirt. I had never seen a shirt look better. On a Jamaica beach in the sun, she wouldn't need a shirt. I didn't think that would prove to be any kind of a major problem. It was a wink that did it to me. She took my coffee cup. She said I had nice eyes. And she winked. Gotta mean something, right? The eyes thing? I've heard that before. An English girl I'd had good times with for a while, she liked my eyes. Said it all the time. They're blue. Equally, people have said they look like icebergs in an Arctic sea. If I concentrate, I can stop them blinking. Gives a stare an intimidating effect. Useful. But Roscoe's wink had been the best part of the day. The only part of the day, really, except Eno's scrambled eggs, which weren't bad. Eggs you can get anywhere. But I'd miss Roscoe. I floated on through the empty evening. Not long after 10, the door from the corridor was unlocked. A uniformed man came in. He carried a clipboard and a shotgun. I looked him over.
a son of the South, a heavy, fleshy man, reddened skin, a big, hard belly and a wide neck, small eyes, a tight, greasy uniform straining to contain him, probably born right there on the farm they commandeered to build the prison. Assistant Warden Spivey, this shift's top boy. Understaffed and harassed, ushering the short-stay guests around by himself, with a shotgun in his big red farmer's hands. He studied his clipboard.
"Which one of you is Hubble?"
he asked. He had a high-pitched voice, at odds with his bulk. Hubble raised his hand briefly, like a boy at grade school. Spivey's little eyes flicked over him, up and down, like a snake's eyes. He grunted and signaled with the clipboard. We formed up and moved out. Hubble was blank and acquiescent, like an exhausted trooper.
"Turn left and follow the red line," Spivey said.
He waved left with the shotgun. There was a red line painted on the wall at waist height. It was a fire lane guide. I guessed it must lead outside, but we were going in the wrong direction. Into the prison, not out of it. We followed the red line through corridors, upstairs, and around corners. Hubble first, then me. Then Spivey with the shotgun. It was very dark, just dim emergency lighting. Spivey called a halt on a landing. He overrode an electronic lock with his key, a lock which would spring the fire door when the alarm went.
"No talking," he said.
"Rules here say absolute silence at all times after lights out. Cell at the end. On the right."
We stepped in through the out door. The foul odor of prison hit me, the night exhalation of countless dispirited men. It was nearly pitch black. A nightlight glowed dimly. I sensed rather than saw rows of cells. I heard the babble of night sounds, breathing and snoring, muttering and whimpering. Spivey walked us to the end of the row, pointed to an empty cell. We crowded in. Spivey swung the bars shut behind us. They locked automatically. He walked away. The cell was very dark. I could just about see a bunk bed, a sink, and a john. Not much floor space. I took off my coat and lobbed it onto the top bunk, reached up, and remade the bed with the pillow away from the bars. I liked it better that way. Worn sheet and blanket, but they smelled clean enough. Hubble sat quietly on the lower bed. I used the john and rinsed my face at the sink, pulled myself up into bed, took off my shoes, left them on the foot of the bed. I wanted to know where they were. Shoes can get stolen. And these were good shoes. Bought many years ago in Oxford, England, a university town near the airbase where I was stationed. Big, heavy shoes with hard soles and a thick welt. The bed was too short for me, but most beds are. I lay there in the dark and listened to the restless prison. Then I closed my eyes and floated back to Jamaica with Roscoe. I must have fallen asleep there with her, because the next thing I knew it was Saturday. I was still in prison, and an even worse day was beginning. 6. I was woken up by bright lights coming on. The prison had no windows. Day and night were created by electricity. At 7 o'clock, the building was suddenly flooded with light. No dawn or soft twilight, just circuit breakers thrown shut at 7. The bright light did not make the cell look any better. The front wall was bars. Half would open outward on a hinge to form the door. The 2 stacked beds occupied just about half the width and most of the length. On the back wall were a steel sink and a steel toilet pan. The walls were masonry, part poured concrete and part old bricks, all thickly covered with paint. The walls looked massively thick, like a dungeon. Above my head was a low concrete ceiling. The cell didn't feel like a room bounded by walls, floor, ceiling. It felt like a solid block of masonry with a tiny living space grudgingly burrowed in. Outside, the restless night mutter was replaced by the clatter of daytime. Everything was metal, brick, concrete. Noises were amplified and echoed around. It sounded like hell. Through the bars, I could see nothing. Opposite our cell was a blank wall. Lying in bed, I didn't have the angle to see down the row. I threw off the cover and found my shoes, put them on and laced them up. Lay down again. Hubble was sitting on the bottom bunk. His tan boat shoes were planted on the concrete floor. I wondered if he had sat like that all night, or if he had slept. Next person I saw was a cleaner. He moved into view outside our bars. This was a very old guy with a broom. An old black man with a fringe of snow-white hair, bent up with age, fragile like a wizened old bird. His orange prison uniform was washed almost white. He must have been 80. Must have been inside for 60 years. Maybe stole a chicken in the Depression. Still paying his debt to society. He stabbed the broom randomly over the corridor. His spine forced his face parallel to the floor. He rolled his head like a swimmer to see from side to side. He caught sight of Hubble and me and stopped, rested on his broom, and shook his head, gave a kind of reflective chuckle, shook his head again. He was chuckling away, an appreciative, delighted chuckle, like at long last, after all these years, he'd been granted the sight of a fabled thing, like a unicorn or a mermaid. He kept trying to speak, raising his hand as if his point was going to require emphasis, but every time he'd start up with the chuckling again and need to clutch the broom. I didn't hurry him. I could wait. I had all weekend. He had the rest of his life.
Well, yes, indeed, he grinned.
He had no teeth.
Well, yes, indeed.
I looked over at him. Well, yes what, Granddad? I grinned back. He was cackling away. This is going to take a while.
Yes, indeed, he said.
Now he had the chuckling under control.
I've been in this joint since God's dog was a puppy. Yes, sir. Since Adam was a young boy. But here's something I ain't never seen. No, sir. Not in all those years.
What ain't you never seen, old man? I asked him.
Well, he said, I've been here all these years, and I ain't never seen anybody in that cell wearing clothes like yours, man.
You don't like my clothes? I said, surprised.
I didn't say that, no, sir. I didn't say I don't like your clothes, he said. I like your clothes just fine. A very fine set of clothes. Yes, sir. Yes, indeed, very fine.
So what's the story, I asked. The old guy was cackling away to himself.
The quality of the clothes ain't the issue, he said. No, sir, that ain't the issue at all. It's the fact you're wearing them, man. Like not wearing the orange uniform. I never saw that before. And like I say, man, I've been here since the earth cooled, since the dinosaurs said enough is enough. Now I've seen everything. I really have. Yes, sir.
But guys on the holding floor don't wear the uniform, I said.
Yes, indeed, that sure is true, the old man said. That's a fact for sure.
The guard said so, I confirmed.
They would say so, he agreed, because that's the rules, and the guards, they know the rules, yes, sir, they know them, because they make them.
So what's the issue, old man? I said.
Well, like I say, you're not wearing the orange suit, he said.
We were going around in circles here. But I don't have to wear it, I said. He was amazed, the sharp bird eyes locked in on me.
You don't, he said. Why is that, man? Tell me.
Because we don't wear it on the holding floor, I said. You just agreed with that, right? There was a silence. He and I got the message simultaneously.
You think this is the holding floor?
He asked me. Isn't this the holding floor? I asked him at the same time. The old guy paused a beat, lifted his broom, and crabbed back out of sight, quickly as he could, shouting incredulously as he went.
This ain't a holding floor, man,
he whooped.
Holding floor is the top floor. Floor 6. It's yes, floor 3. You're on floor 3, man. This is lifers, man. This is categorized dangerous people, man. This ain't even general population. This is the voice, man. Yes, indeed. You boys are in the wrong place. You boys are in trouble. Yes, indeed. You gonna get visitors. They're gonna check you boys out. Oh, man, I'm out of here.
Evaluate. Long experience had taught me to evaluate and assess. When the unexpected gets dumped on you, don't waste time. Don't figure out how or why it happened. Don't recriminate. Don't figure out whose fault it is. Don't work out how to avoid the same mistake next time. All of that you do later, if you survive. First of all, you evaluate. Analyze the situation. Identify the downside. Assess the upside. Plan accordingly. Do all that, and you give yourself a better chance of getting through to the other stuff later. We were not in the holding pens on the 6th floor, not where unconvicted prisoners should be. We were among dangerous lifers on the 3rd. There was no upside. The downside was extensive. We were new boys on a convict floor. We would not survive without status. We had no status. We would be challenged. We would be made to embrace our position at the absolute bottom of the pecking order. We faced an unpleasant weekend, potentially a lethal one. I remembered an army guy, a deserter. Young guy, not a bad recruit, went AWOL because he got some nut religion. Got into trouble in Washington, demonstrating. Ended up thrown in jail, among bad guys like on this floor. Died on his first night. Anally raped, an estimated 50 times. And at the autopsy, they found a pint of semen in his stomach. A new boy with no status, right at the bottom of the pecking order. Available to all those above him. Assess. I could call on some heavy training and experience. Not intended for prison life, but it would help. I had gone through a lot of unpleasant education, not just in the Army, stretching right back into childhood. Between grade school and high school, military kids like me get to go to 20, maybe 30 new schools, some on bases, most in local neighborhoods, in some tough places. Philippines, Korea, Iceland, Germany, Scotland, Japan, Vietnam, all over the world. The first day at each new school, I was a new boy, with no status. Lots of first days. I quickly learned how to get status. In sandy, hot schoolyards, in cold, wet schoolyards, my brother and I had slugged it out together, back to back. We had got status. Then in the service itself, that brutality was refined. I was trained by experts, guys who traced their own training back to World War II, Korea, Vietnam, people who had survived things I had only read about in books. They taught me methods, details, skills. Most of all, they taught me attitude. They taught me that inhibitions would kill me. Hit early, hit hard. Kill with the first blow. Get your retaliation in first. Cheat. The gentlemen who behaved decently weren't there to train anybody. They were already dead. At 7:30, there was a ragged clunk along the row of cells. The time switch had unlocked the cages. Our bars sagged open an inch. Hubble sat motionless, still silent. I had no plan. Best option would be to find a guard, explain, and get transferred. But I didn't expect to find a guard. On floors like this, they wouldn't patrol singly. They would move in pairs, possibly in groups of three or four. The prison was understaffed. That had been made clear last night. Unlikely to be enough manpower to provide groups of guards on each floor. Probability was, I wouldn't see a guard all day. They would wait in a crew room, operate as a crash squad responding to emergencies. And if I did see a guard, what would I say? I shouldn't be here? They must hear that all day long. They would ask, who put you here? I would say, Spivey, the top boy. They would say, well, that's okay then, right? So the only plan was no plan. Wait and see. React accordingly. Objective, survival until Monday. I could hear the grinding as the other inmates swung back their gates and latched them open. I could hear movement and shouted conversation as they strolled out to start another pointless day. I waited. Not long to wait. From my tight angle on the bed, head away from the door, I saw our next-door neighbors stroll out. They merged with a small knot of men. They were all dressed the same. Orange prison uniform. Red bandanas tight over shaved heads. Huge black guys. Obviously bodybuilders. Several had torn the sleeves off their shirts, suggesting that no available garment could contain their massive bulk. They may have been right. An impressive sight. The nearest guy was wearing pale sunglasses, the sort which darken in the sun, silver halide. The guy had probably last seen the sun in the 70s, may never see it again. So the shades were redundant, but they looked good. Like the muscles, like the bandanas and the torn shirts, all image. I waited. The guy with the sunglasses spotted us. His look of surprise quickly changed to excitement. He alerted the group's biggest guy by hitting his arm. The big man looked round. He looked blank. Then he grinned. I waited. The knot of men assembled outside our cell. They gazed in. The big guy pulled open our gate. The others passed it from hand to hand through its arc. They latched it open.
Look what they sent us, the big guy said.
You know what they sent us?
What they sent us?
The sunglasses guy said.
They sent us fresh meat,
the big guy answered.
They sure did, man,
the sunglasses guy said. Fresh meat.
Fresh meat for everybody,
the big guy said. He grinned. He looked around his gang, and they all grinned back, exchanged low fives. I waited. The big guy stepped half a pace into our cell. He was enormous, maybe an inch or two shorter than me, but probably twice as heavy. He filled the doorway. His dull eyes flicked over me, then Hubble.
Yo, white boy, come here,
he said, to Hubble. I could sense Hubble's panic. He didn't move.
Come here, white boy,
the big guy repeated quietly. Hubble stood up, took half a pace toward the man at the door. The big guy was glaring with that rage glare that is supposed to chill you with its ferocity.
This is Red Boy territory, man,
the big guy said, explaining the bandanas.
What's Whitey doing in Red Boy territory?
Hubble said nothing in reply.
Residency tax, man,
the big guy said.
Like they got in Florida hotels, man.
You got to pay the tax.
Give me your sweater, white boy.
Hubble was rigid with fear.
Give me your sweater, white boy, he said again,
quietly. Hubble unwrapped his expensive white sweater and held it out. The big man took it and threw it behind him without looking.
Give me the eyeglasses, white boy, he said.
Hubble flicked a despairing glance up at me, took off his gold glasses, held them out. The big man took them and dropped them to the floor, crunched them under his shoe, screwed his foot around. The glasses smashed and splintered. The big man scraped his foot back and flicked the wreckage backward into the corridor. The other guys all took turns stamping on them.
Good boy, the big guy said. You paid the tax.
Hubble was trembling.
Now come here, white boy, said his tormentor.
Hubble shuffled nearer.
Closer. White boy,
the big man said. Hubble shuffled nearer until he was a foot away. He was shaking.
On your knees, white boy, said the big guy.
Hubble knelt.
Unzip me, Whitey, he said.
Hubble did nothing, filled with panic.
Unzip me, white boy.
The big guy said again,
with your teeth.
Hubble gave a gasp of fear and revulsion and jumped back. He scuttled backward to the rear of the cell, tried to hide behind the John. He was practically hugging the pan.
Time to intervene.
Not for Hubble. I felt nothing for him, but I had to intervene for myself. Hubble's abject performance would taint me. We would be seen as a pair. Hubble's surrender would disqualify us both in the status game.
Come back, white boy. Don't you like me?
The big guy called Hubble. I took a long, silent breath, swung my feet over the side of the bunk, and landed lightly in front of the big man. He stared at me. I stared back, calmly.
You're in my house, fat boy, I said. But I'm going to give you a choice.
Choice of what? Said the big guy, blankly, surprised. A choice of exit strategies, fat boy, I said.
Say what?
He said. What I mean is this, I said. You're going to leave. That's for sure. Your choice is about how you leave. Either you can walk out of here by yourself, or these other fat boys behind you are going to carry you out in a bucket.
Oh, yeah?
He said. For sure, I said. I'm going to count to three, okay? So you better choose real quick, right? He glared at me. One, I counted. No response. Two, I counted. No response. Then I cheated. Instead of counting three, I headbutted him, full in the face, came off the back foot with a thrust up the legs and whipped my head forward and smashed it into his nose. It was beautifully done. The forehead is a perfect arch in all planes and very strong. The skull at the front is very thick. I have a ridge up there like concrete. The human head is very heavy. All kinds of neck muscles and back muscles balance it. It's like getting hit in the face with a bowling ball. It's always a surprise. People expect punching or kicking. A headbutt is always unexpected. It comes out of the blue. It must have caved his whole face in. I guess I'd pulped his nose and smashed both his cheekbones, jarred his little brain around real good. His legs crumpled, and he hit the floor like a puppet with the strings cut, like an ox in the slaughterhouse. His skull cracked on the concrete floor. I stared around the knot of men. They were busy reassessing my status. "Who's next?" I said. "But this is like Vegas now. It's double or quits. This guy is going to the hospital. Maybe 6 weeks in a metal mask. So the next guy gets 12 weeks in the hospital. You understand that? Couple of smashed elbows, right? So who's next?" There was no reply. I pointed at the guy in sunglasses. "Give me the sweater, fat boy," I said. He bent and picked up the sweater, passed it to me, leaned over and held it out. Didn't want to get too close. I took the sweater and tossed it onto Hubble's bunk. "Give me the eyeglasses," I said. He bent and swept up the twisted gold wreckage, handed it to me. I tossed it back at him. "They're broken, fat boy," I said. "Give me yours." There was a long pause. He looked at me. I looked at him, without blinking. He took off his sunglasses and handed them to me. I put them in my pocket. "Now get this carcass out of here," I said. The bunch of men in their orange uniforms and their red bandanas straightened out the slack limbs and dragged the big man away. I crawled back up into my bunk. I was shaking with adrenaline rush. My stomach was churning and I was panting. My circulation had just about shut down. I felt terrible, but not as bad as I would have felt if I hadn't done it. They'd have finished with Hubble by then and started in on me. I didn't eat any breakfast, no appetite. I just lay on the bunk until I felt better. Hubble sat on his bed. He was rocking back and forward. He still hadn't spoken. After a while, I slid to the floor, washed at the sink. People were strolling up to the doorway and gazing in, strolling away. The word had gotten around fast. The new guy in the cell at the end had sent a red boy to the hospital. Check it out. I was a celebrity. Hubble stopped his rocking and looked at me, opened his mouth and closed it again, opened it for a second time.
"I can't take this," he said.
They were the first words I had heard him say since his assured banter on Finley's speakerphone. His voice was low, but his statement was definite. Not a whine or a complaint, but a statement of fact. He couldn't take this. I looked over at him, considered his statement for a long moment. "So why are you here?" I asked him. "What are you doing?"
"I'm not doing anything," he said.
blankly. "You confessed to something you didn't do," I said. "You asked for this."
"No," said Hubble.